So I thought tonight that because of our current state of the world, because it seems so chaotic and troubling lately, that it might be helpful for us to dive into the Buddha's main teaching on joy, which in Pali is called mudita, or empathetic, sympathetic joy. And I have to confess I have a special fondness for the word mudita, because it happens to be the name of one of my kitties. She brings me great joy every morning, all day. And my other cat's name is Sukha, which means bliss. So I get happiness and bliss most days. And mudita, many of you may know, is called one of the four divine abodes, or the Brahma Viharas. And these are the four supreme qualities of mind and heart that the Buddha asks us to continually nurture and cultivate, so that eventually we can actually live or dwell in these states, right? They become our homes. And of course, our home is here in the body, right? Our bodies are our homes. Mudita, joy, is the third of the Brahma Viharas, along with kindness and compassion and equanimity, balance. And before I continue, I want to confess and maybe mention that, actually, or ask, who was at Jonathan Faust's class? Anybody on Monday? A couple of people? Okay. What about my retreat at the Brahma Viharas in August? Anybody? Oh, good. Okay, just a couple of people. I feel better. So to those of you who are at Jonathan's, I apologize. I'm giving a very similar talk. And if it helps, Tara told me that those who double dip from Tara and Jonathan's talk, they get twice the bliss. So there you go. So when it comes to the Brahma Viharas, I always find it interesting that mudita in particular is one that a lot of Western teachers don't seem to emphasize as much, bless you. And I think there's a reason for this. One of the reasons is that I think kindness and compassion are so needed and really emphasized a lot. And so is equanimity and balance is something we really need. And mudita just kind of sometimes gets a short shrift. And I think one of the reasons for this in our Western culture is that it's actually really hard. It's actually a really difficult practice. And if you can recall the truth that our beliefs and perceptions are conditioned based on our upbringing and our culture and basically the water that we're swimming in, we might recognize that as Westerners, those of us who have been brought up in the West, are very conditioned to have strong beliefs about the importance of the individual as opposed to the group. Am I right? Yeah? It's just a conditioned perception. And as the teachings show us, this perception of the individual actually causes us so much pain. You know, it's one of the greatest sources of our suffering, is a sense of feeling separate from one another. And I recently read a fascinating study where researchers took a picture of a little girl who was smiling big and broadly in the middle of a group of other little girls who all looked sad. And researchers showed the photograph to groups of children who grow up in the Western part of our world and asked them if they thought that she was happy. And they all said, of course, yes, she was. She's happy. But when they showed the photo, the same photo, to groups of children who were brought up in the more Eastern countries in our world, they all said she was sad. Isn't that interesting? Why was this? The researchers said that the children who grew up in the Western part of our world have no problem isolating an individual from a group, whereas children who grew up in the more Eastern countries take it for granted that if the girl was surrounded by distress, that she would be distressed too. I just find that fascinating. And again, as the teachings tell us, our sense of being separate is an illusion. It's a delusion. And the happiness of others really affects all of us. And our happiness affects others as well. Which is why the practice of mudita, M-U-D-I-T-A, is so important. It's both a wish for our own and others' happiness, and an attunement, like a musical instrument, like an attunement with the happiness of others. It's a connection. So mudita, just like all the other Brahma Viharas, is said to grow out of the soil of metta, loving kindness, or goodwill. It is essentially what goodwill or metta feels when it encounters happiness and goodness, it wants the happiness and goodness to continue. It's what it feels. So when we're experiencing empathetic or sympathetic joy, our hearts are in essence resonating with the happiness and good hearts of others, if you check it out. So in a way, we're rejoicing that our own wish for others' happiness is actually coming to fruition. We're witnessing, we're seeing it, and we're actually feeling it too, which is a great part. We get to feel it in ourselves. We don't just get to witness it. When we're practicing mudita, we're feeling it in our own heart. It's fantastic. It's also what we feel when we simply wish for others to be happy. Even if that wish never comes true, we still get to feel that wish for their happiness, and it opens our hearts. So with mudita, it's our wish or aspiration that's important for our practice, because this wish can help dissolve our sense of separateness, along with our sense of aversion or hatred and greed and ill will. Just for instance, think about what happens when to our hearts and minds when we have the opposite wish. Just check it out. Think about that, right? When we're feeling hatred or aversion towards somebody or others, or maybe even if we wish for them to suffer in some way. You know? This toxic state of mind and heart is exactly what we're trying to counter by cultivating our wish for our own and others' happiness. And so in the famous Metta Sutta, which many of you may know, the Buddha's prayer includes this: happy, at rest, may all beings be happy at heart. Whatever beings there may be, weak or strong, without exception, long, large, middling, short, subtle, blatant, seen and unseen, near and far, born and seeking birth, may all beings be happy at heart. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere, or through anger or irritation wish for another to suffer. So that's a pretty tall order, isn't it? It's pretty big. He's asking us to wish for the happiness of all beings without exception, and not to despise anyone either, including ourselves. And of course, it's that without exception part that's the most difficult. So for instance, it might be really easy for us to wish for our pets or our children or our loved ones to be happy. That's sort of automatic, isn't it? We kind of just do that automatically. That's super easy. That's not hard. We want their happiness, of course. But what about ourselves? Really think about that. What about ourselves? Do you allow yourself to be happy or to wish yourself happy? Or maybe, what about all those beings we think should really be on the receiving end of suffering? You know? How often do we really practice wishing them happiness? You know? So what the Buddha is urging us to do, is actually to not only wish for their happiness too, but to do this often as a consistent practice. And there's a reason for this, which is that if someone truly knows the causes of happiness and are happy themselves, they're going to be much less likely to cause themselves and others so much harm. Isn't that true? So again, the happiness of others really does affect us. So as an example, just for a moment, as a reflection, you might think of anybody in your life right now who's caused harm, maybe in your family or community or job or whatever it is, or maybe those out in the world who are causing great harm. Haven't each of them done this out of a sense of unhappiness of some sort? You know, aren't they acting out of greed or aversion or hatred or delusion every time there's harm, right? It's not done out of joy. And when we ourselves do ourselves or others harm, isn't it usually when we ourselves are acting out of, if you check this out, whenever you've done harm, there's been some sort of greed, aversion, hatred, or delusion of some sort. And when we're acting out of what are called the three poisons, greed, hatred, or delusion, it's really not bringing us or anybody else happiness, although it might masquerade this way a little bit. In reality, it's a super painful place to live, and it's definitely not the bliss states. And by the way, the Buddha isn't telling us that we can only be happy when everybody else is happy. It's not it at all. He's asking us to be happy and to cultivate limitless joy within ourselves and then to share that, to not keep it to ourselves. You know, sometimes it's called unselfish joy. Unselfish. We're sharing it. Okay. The Dalai Lama, in fact, has suggested that the practice of wishing happiness for everyone, not just for ourselves, just makes logical sense. He says, if I'm only happy for myself, many fewer chances for happiness. If I am happy when good things happen to other people, billions more chances to be happy. So, the instructions are pretty clear, aren't they? But why then is it so difficult? It's so difficult. And there's many reasons for this. And one of the first is that even though we can all intellectually acknowledge that these practices will likely lead us to more joy in our lives, sometimes we can feel like it's a really selfish thing, right? Especially when others are struggling or suffering. We might experience a sense of deep guilt about this or see a belief that looks like I shouldn't be happy when others are suffering, right? We can get into a really big case of the shoulds here. I shouldn't because X, Y, and Z. I shouldn't because this person. I shouldn't because fill in the blank. And as I've said before, whenever you catch a should in your mind, right, a should, it's toxic, right? So don't should all over yourselves. Is that an easy way to remember it? They're toxic, the shoulds. So it's really important to remember that our wish or our aspiration for all beings to be happy and to know the causes of happiness absolutely needs to include ourselves. Okay? This is, again, because when we're happy, we're going to be much less likely to be filled with hate or greed or delusion, and therefore we're going to be less likely to cause harm. Really important. Our happiness is also really needed. And, you know, this happiness needs to be shared. The world needs more joy in it, especially in the face of great suffering. It needs people who are feeling joyous. My favorite Buddhist nun, Pema Chodron, I was brought up in the Shambhala tradition, so Pema's kind of my hero in a way. She tells us, times are difficult globally. Awakening is no longer a luxury or an ideal. It is becoming critical. We do not need to add more depression, more discouragement, or more anger to what is already here. It's becoming essential that we learn how to relate sanely with difficult times. The earth seems to be beseeching us to connect with joy and discover our innermost essence. This is the best way that we can benefit others. This is the best way that we can benefit others. In a very similar way, the Buddha tells us, overcome your uncertainties and free yourself from dwelling on sorrow. When you delight in existence, you will awaken and become a guide to those in need, revealing the path to many. I'm going to read that again. Overcome your uncertainties and free yourself from dwelling on sorrow. When you delight in existence, you will awaken and become a guide to those in need, revealing the path to many. Okay. Some of you may know that I have a practice of saving very short, memorable quotes and writing them down on sticky notes and putting them around my house because it's a really good mind training practice. And one of my favorites is from the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, who tells us, suffering is not enough. I love that. It's so simple to remember, right? Suffering's not enough. And besides Thich Nhat Hanh, maybe our greatest living example of what the consistent practice of mudita can do is the Dalai Lama. He's such a beautiful embodiment of all the Brahmaviharas, and he really lives in them, despite all the atrocities that, you know, he's had to witness in his life. And people all over the world say that every time they see the Dalai Lama, he's either laughing or smiling, right? And whenever anyone asks him if he's happy, it's immediate, without hesitation. He says, yes, yes, I'm very happy. He actually calls himself a professional laugher. And I love to remember that the Buddha himself was known as the happy one. You know, there's so much emphasis on suffering in the Buddhist practice that we forget that, you know, we're trying to become happy, and the Buddha was the happy one. The great monk and scholar Thanissaro Bhikkhu tells us, it's not that other people don't behave in evil, outrageous, horrible ways. There are people like that in the world. But if your peace of mind were totally dependent on everyone else's behaving themselves, you would be their slave. You would never get free. But as the Buddha said, the whole issue of suffering is something that we can overcome through our own efforts. This means that we have to look at the suffering that we create for ourselves. So as the teachings show us, our more sustained happiness is actually built very consciously through our practice, which helps us to clearly recognize, as we're practicing, which mind states and action lead to happiness and which mind states and action lead us to suffering. It's almost that simple. In my own sangha in Winchester, Virginia, which is about an hour or so east of here, or west, sorry, we start every week with a community practice in our sangha, which is a little bit about what I offered here, but we do it out loud, and we have each person, about 40 people, and we go around, and each person shares their name and then a joy for the week or the day, and it's a way to build the mudita, and we go around the room, and after 40 people have shared, everyone is just beaming at the end. We're really just beaming with mudita. You know, we're feeling very connected as a sangha and a community. We're kind of in communion, union with each other, not feeling separate. And if you'll remember again, feeling separate is our deepest wounding and our biggest delusion. So part of the beauty of mudita practice, I think, is that when we can truly, authentically rejoice in someone else's experience of happiness, what happens is that we can feel the exact same thing in ourselves. It resonates in our own heart because we're connected. Okay? So it resonates in our own bodies and minds and hearts. What is also cool is that we get a little glimpse of another person's innate goodness. And that goodness also resonates in our own good heart. And our animosity and ill will tends to fall away, even if it's temporarily. You might pick it up again 2 minutes later, right? But it can fall away in that moment that you're noticing their joy. So you might, for instance, notice that the person that you are feeling animosity in some way towards loves their children or their pet or something beautiful in nature. At the retreat I was on at Seven Oaks, this 5-day retreat on the Brahmaviharas that I was leading, there was a double rainbow right before the talk on joy. It was perfect timing. But everyone was outside in silence, just all together, just enjoying this rainbow, right? And there was not a sense of animosity. It was, you know, you get that when you're watching something beautiful together. You might pick it up again later. But it was a beautiful moment. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who founded the Tibetan Shambhala tradition again, which I was originally trained in, said that if you're experiencing a lot of aversion or hatred towards someone, you might practice imagining all the things that that person might love and see what that does. So I'm going to throw that out there as a practice for you this week. And he said, everyone loves something, even if it's just tortillas. So it might also be helpful to remember that the definition of mudita includes a sense of empathy or empathetic joy. So instead of tuning into someone else's pain, we're tuning into someone else's sense of joy. They both connect us. So someone else's pain connects us when we can tune into it, and so does feeling someone else's joy. It's being connected in the tears of sorrow and in those tears of joy. Because mudita is about letting go of a strong sense of self, it's really important here to remember that mudita should not be confused with pride. Okay? Since pride evokes a sense of self always, doesn't it? If you check it out, pride invokes a sense of only I get to ride the wave of this particular person's joy, but not other people. It's exclusive, right? So it's like, it's my loved one, my friend, my team, my political party, my country, etc. This is not mudita, although it's considered the near enemy of joy because it can masquerade as mudita. But pride, if you start to look at it, always involves propping up a self, not expanding a self, opening. It's propping it up. And it might be helpful to remember whenever you have pride that this is what leads to actual wars, right? Pride, think about that. So when we're exploring mudita in our practice, it's important to pay close attention to those mind states that are considered the very opposite of unselfish joy. And these are sometimes called the far enemies of joy, the far enemies. Pride is the near enemy because it masquerades. The far enemies, if you might imagine, are envy and greed. And of course, greed is part of envy. So with envy, if you think about it, we're not only coveting what someone else has, we're in a way wanting to have it all for ourselves. We don't want to share. Or maybe we're fearful that there isn't enough to go around. So there can be this sense of, well, if they have it, then I can't have it too. Okay. A really great example of this is from a story I once read about a door-to-door salesman who said that for almost an entire decade, he won Salesperson of the Year every single year by perfecting this one classic line, which was, let me show you something several of your neighbors said that you couldn't afford. So there's envy, and there's greed, and then there's a third far enemy of joy, which is often the result of these two, which is Schadenfreude. And this is a German word that means taking pleasure in the misfortune of others. And a German student who attended the retreat I was on in July on the Brahmaviharas was coaching me on how to say it, because I still don't think I say it right. But he told me it was a compound word of Scheuden, which means damage or harm, and Freud, which means joy. Isn't that interesting? The writer Anne Lamont, who loves Anne Lamont? Show of hands. She's great if you don't know who Anne Lamont is. I adore her. And she once described how difficult it was for her to deal with the success of other writers, especially if they were friends of hers. And she said, it can wreak just the tiniest bit of havoc with your self-esteem to find that you're hoping for small, bad things to happen to this friend. For say, like, for her head to blow up. So I think she hit all three of the enemies of joy there. There's also a pop culture word that refers to when you're so envious of one of your friends that you just almost can't stand it. And with this, when this happens, you have friend-vy. Unfortunately, social psychologists who've studied envy say that among the seven deadlies, it occupies a unique position. It's the only sin that is never any fun. The others are kind of fun, aren't they? This one, not so much. And it's just, you know, it's sad, but it's so true. It's not fun for you who's experiencing envy. And by the way, it's really not fun for the person on the receiving end of it. So not fun. Have you ever been envied? Think about this. Maybe a sibling or a coworker or someone. Have you ever been envied? How does that feel? Really, how does it feel to be envied? You know, or you might consider, did you ever really want to share a joy really bad with someone but held back because you were afraid they were going to be jealous? And how did that feel? What did that feel to keep it in there, not be able to share that joy? And that's what happens when we are envious. That other person doesn't get to share their joy. They have to hold it inside to protect us, and that's not fair. Or maybe you did share a joy at some point, and the person who was listening just didn't join in. How did that feel? How did that feel, you know? As a singer and actress Bette Midler once said, the worst part of success is trying to find someone who is happy for you. In the cover story of Tricycle Magazine a few years back, the author Joan Duncan Oliver wrote this about envy. However couched it might be, envy by its very nature is hostile. The word comes from the Latin indivere, to regard maliciously, to grudge. Unlike its cousin greed, envy doesn't just crave the object of its desire, it taints the whole project, begrudging others what they have, and when all else fails, devaluing and destroying the desired object. So it's really important to remember in our practice that the person is not the object of our envy. The real object is the thing that they have that you are envying, isn't it? It's not the person, although we identify the two. So when through your awareness practice you can take a closer look, it might help to examine what are you wanting in your life more intimately. When you're envying someone, instead of focusing all your energy, I hate that person, I want their head to blow up, whatever that is. What are you wanting? What are you wanting? Remembering that the wanting is in no way wrong, by the way. So to have deep compassion for yourself for this wanting, it's wanting it to be a certain way, of course, that causes us suffering. But the wanting is in no way wrong. Or maybe wanting it all for ourselves, not to have anybody else have it. That's also kind of a wrong way to look at it. That's greed coming in. Anne Ulanoff, the author of Cinderella and Her Sisters, The Envied and the Envying, suggests, envy, so spoiling and injurious, can, if suffered consciously, point us toward the good that we thirst for. I'll read that again. Envy, so spoiling and injurious, can, if suffered consciously, point us toward the good that we thirst for. And so once we've really seen this and examined it through our practice, it makes it much easier for us to be able to offer our mudita to the person before us, because we can recognize the suffering of our own conditioning. Okay? It's also helpful to remember that we all suffer. Is anybody not suffering here? Show of hands. Nobody, right? We all suffer. Even those who seem to have something we want. Helpful to remember. Or those people we don't like, or maybe feel don't deserve it in some way. There was a bumper sticker that I saw one time, which has become another one of my sticky notes. It's helpful to remember. It simply said, "Mean people suffer." I also like to think of the words of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who wrote, "If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." Yeah. So an important part of the mudita practice involves remembering the first two Brahmaviharas, which are kindness and compassion, and applying these not only towards yourself, but all of those who you might envy or even despise. And when we work with our envy as well as our pride, it's also helpful to remember the Buddha's teaching on how we practice, how we meditate. So when we can see that we're suffering from thoughts of envy and pride, we consciously, very consciously abandon them, remembering not to water those roots. Don't continue to chew on those roots. Water those roots. You know, rev them up or indulge in all those, you know, juicy visions of Schadenfreude. We don't do that. So mudita is also something we can really actively cultivate by intentionally, mindfully looking for it, for being on the watch very consciously for those times when people are experiencing joy in their lives. We don't just let it pass because it's not happening to us and it really doesn't matter and I don't know that person too well and, you know, we just say, oh, that's nice, and we don't lean into that. So for instance, whenever we maybe hear distant laughter, we are asked to actually notice it and ride that wave of joy, to catch some of it and feel connected to it, to resonate with it. And by the way, once you start looking for it consciously, it's amazing how much of this is out there, right? How much joy you can actually connect to. You know, we don't have to produce it all ourselves. We can just ride the wave of everybody else's joy. You know, the Dalai Lama suggests that we can't be too greedy with this one. This is one of those things where we can't be too greedy with finding joy. And finally, as we continue to nurture and build our mudita, just like all the other Brahmaviharas, it's said that this inner wellspring of joy eventually becomes unlimited. That's why it's sometimes they're called the immeasurables. They're unlimited. And this means not just limited to those we love or people in our personal circle. It becomes available and offered out to everyone and everything around us. Okay. In the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha tells us, "Here, O monks," which means us, "a disciple lets one's mind pervade one quarter of the world with thoughts of unselfish joy, and so the second, and so the third, and so the fourth, and thus the whole wide world, above, below, around, everywhere and equally, one continues to pervade with a heart of unselfish joy, abundant, grown great, measureless, without hostility or ill will." Yeah. So in the time that we have left, very briefly, I'd like to offer you a meditation practice on this very briefly. But since you've been sitting, I'm going to invite you just to stand for a minute first and stretch. Right. So I'm going to invite you all just to close the eyes as you're ready. Again, just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out, letting go, let the shoulders drop. A couple of rounds of these on your own just to get in touch with the breath. Really let the breath calm the body, especially on the exhale, just letting go. You might notice your hands and see if you can loosen the hands, open the hands. again, I'm going to invite those of you who would like to place a slight smile on the face and the lips and the eyes. Doesn't have to be a big smile, but it can be. It feels good. This breathing. And those of you who would like to get in touch with the heart, I'd like to invite you to place one hand or both hands on the heart, or maybe one hand on the heart, one hand on the belly. Whatever feels good as a way of kind of holding yourself, holding your heart. I'm going to invite you to silently say these words to yourself in your mind and really feel your aspiration for this. Try to lean into this wish for yourself. Very simply, may I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from fear. Might use your breath with each one. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from fear. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from fear. Stay with it. Really wish this for yourself. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from fear. I'm going to invite you now just a very slightly, as you're ready, very, very slightly, open the eyes and look at the person to your left. And look at their knees or their feet. Maybe just get a sense of them. If there's nobody to your left, look at the person maybe in front of you. Just pick one person. And then once you get a sense of them, close the eyes again. Once you get a sense of this person, close your eyes. Keeping the sense of this being in your heart and mind, start wishing them well as well. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be free from fear. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be free from fear. Continue to send your well wishes to this person next to you or in front of you. And really wish that for them. May you be happy. May you be well. May you be free from fear. See what that does to the heart to wish them well. Remember that each one of us suffers in their own way. And so does this being that you're offering your words to. And now I'm going to invite you to repeat this wish for the two of you. May we both be happy. May we both be well. May we both be free from fear. So include yourself in that. May we both be happy. May we both be well. May we both be free from fear. See if you can sense a connection. Might start offering that same wish to all of us here who came to practice together tonight. All of us here in this room, including yourself. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. Really sense your belonging in the room here. This particular configuration of people which will never be the same again. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. Finally, you might try sending this wish out to all beings everywhere without exception. Without exception. Remembering that if people are happy and know the causes of happiness, they are going to be less likely to cause more harm. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. May we all be happy. May we all be well. May we all be free from fear. Finally, just as encouragement from the Buddha, overcome your uncertainties and free yourself from dwelling on sorrow. When you delight in existence, you will awaken and become a guide to those in need, revealing the path to many.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.